Hello and welcome to the Society for Acute Medicine's podcast. Here we discuss topics, cases, and anything new and upcoming in the world of acute medicine. This is our view and take. Remember to always do your own reading around the topics we discuss. Enjoy!
Hello everybody and welcome to another episode of the SAM podcast. There's a few of us here today and we're going to do another one of our episodes about kind of cases that kind of had an impact on our practice. So I'm Mike Weeble, I'm a consultant down in Bournemouth, and with me on this episode is Damien.
Hi, thanks Mike. I'm Damien Dewey, I am a consultant at Warrington Hospital.
I've got Peter.
Hi, I'm Peter Ing, I'm an AMU consultant up in Liverpool.
And Vicky.
Hello, I'm Vicky Price, I'm also a consultant up in Liverpool.
So this episode we're going to hear from Peter and Vicky, and to start us off we're going to have Vicky tell us about her case. So over to you, Vic.
Thanks very much. So I had a bit of a think about what I could talk about on this podcast, because a lot of you are aware of my talk that I've done for SAM Council when I sort of bared my soul, so I didn't really want to revisit that. So I thought about something else that's sort of fairly early on in my consultant career that has had more of an impact than I realised probably at the time. So this happened in my first year of being a consultant, and a fairly standard case. So I'm doing a ward round and I get to see a chap who's got quite significant psychiatric problems, and he's been sent to us with a low sodium. And while I'm seeing him, he's drinking quite a lot of water. So already I'm thinking, I remember my membership here. I think I might know what's going on here. So I had a chat to him. He'd been feeling pretty low recently. He was under a psychiatrist, and he felt the need to drink quite a lot of water. And so his bloods had come back, and the reason he'd been referred to medicine was that he had hyponatremia. And his sodium was in the range of about 127, 128. So not particularly drastically low. And it had been done the day before, and it had been 125. And when I saw him, I think it was 128. So it'd been a bit better. So I examined him, I didn't find anything abnormal at all on examination. The rest of his bloods were pretty normal. Renal function, everything else was fine. His potassium was fine. His blood pressure, if anything, was slightly on the high side. So sort of thinking, well, this is not like an Addisonian picture. And my working diagnosis was psychogenic polydipsia with an associated hyponatremia. So on my ward round, I asked for a serum, urine, and osmolality. And I made that as my tentative diagnosis. And if it was, my suggestion was that we would try and fluid restrict. And then he could probably go home and we could follow him up if his sodium was continuing to improve. So that was my end involvement. That's it, done, finished. He got seen by a consultant of mine later on that following day, because I'd put him on the sort of review list for a possible discharge. They saw him with the serum, urine, and osmolalities. His sodium had stayed around the same, so they discharged him. And then he came back 4 or 5 days later to our clinic. We used to have a clinic at the time rather than an ambulatory care thing. And so he saw another one of my colleagues who took the history and again noticed that he'd got a bottle of water. He'd had a repeat sodium, remained about the same. I think it was always roughly around the ballpark of 128, 129, 130. And my colleagues were in clinic and noticed he was drinking water and just said, look, you've got this condition where you're drinking too much water and it's lowering your sodium. You really need to try and stop. And my colleague became quite infamous potentially after this for a little while, because advised the patient that they should try to spit, not swallow, which always is a bit of a thing that we giggle about afterwards. But basically he was trying to just, you know, control his urge to drink water, and referred him on to his psychologist that he was under anyway, a psychiatrist. And he was discharged from AMU clinic. And 2 weeks later, the clinical lead at the time got a letter and from the GP complaining about the care of this patient. And the clinical lead brought me into the office and said, look at everything you've done. What did you forget to do? I was like, I don't know. I went through everything. I just couldn't think of what I'd forgotten to do. And I looked back at the notes and couldn't think of anything else. Maybe thyroid function. I thought about diabetes. Oh, had I thought about diabetes? And his sugar was 40. He was on a number of medications, one of which increases your risk of getting type 2 diabetes. He was quite an obese chap. And his sugar had been 40, and we'd never checked the sugar at all. So it took me ages going through with the clinical lead till I got to that. I think I was considering all these other things about he hadn't been diarrhea and vomiting, he wasn't hypovolemic. And I thought that little flow chart of managing a low sodium. And I was like, even if I'd have followed that, I don't think it'd have helped me really. And I suppose I felt really stupid afterwards. And I think one of the reasons that this is such an important case was because it was the first time that I'd had something picked up as a consultant. And that was tricky because I think you feel like as a consultant, you should just get everything right all the time. And you know now that as been doing the consultant role now for a number of years, that it still happens that you miss stuff. And it's you still feel really stupid, but the first time you don't pick something up, it's tough. And then it also was the first time I'd ever heard the phrase diagnostic drift, or you know, diagnostic bias. And it was the first sort of I'd never heard of that before, and we talked about it quite a lot, but I'd come up with that diagnosis and two consultant colleagues afterwards had just continued, and the patient was sort of confirming it because they were clutching onto this bottle of water. That they were really thirsty because they had a sugar of 40. So, yeah, there was quite a lot of lessons for me there. The first was sort of dealing with feeling a bit stupid after making a mistake. The second is I'm now obsessed with people with low sodiums and checking their glucose is the first thing I do. And even now I've just been Googling hyponatremia pathways. And not that many of them have check the sugar at the top. There's a few, but if you sort of Google hyponatremia pathway on your phone, I think that I just did it quickly then, and one out of the six had it. And it's such an obvious thing to do, but it's not always thought of. And then the other lesson learned was just this confirmation bias, and I'd not heard of that as a thing before, and now I see it so many times. The ED doctor makes a tentative diagnosis, which is maybe completely reasonable, but then it sort of gets anchored. And that's something I try really hard and to not do. And I've got a number of colleagues that do lots of different things. One of my colleagues refuses to read the ED Clarke before they see the patient. Now, I must confess I don't do that. And I'd be really interested to hear what you guys do and how you can sort of get away from that. So I thought that was quite an interesting one because it raises a few different points. First of all, the bit about making a mistake as a consultant and how you cope with feeling a bit stupid. The second is the sort of diagnostic drift. And then the other one is just the hyponatremia. For goodness sake, check the glucose.
I think there's a saying, isn't it, that it takes a good doctor to change someone else's diagnosis, but it takes a great doctor to change your own diagnosis or something like that. And I think that really holds true for something like this. And it's such an easy omission to do. It's so easy to just not check that sugar, especially if half the pathways you look at, or most pathways, don't include that in the pathway checking sugar. And you see that diagnostic anchoring all the time, particularly pleuritic chest pains, ODD, the arm is raised. We must think that this is a PE. When there's so many other things, when clinically you can take history and examine the patient, and you can probably save that patient going through that PE pathway, because clinically you can usually put your finger on something else rather than being a PE. I think that's a really interesting case. Thank you for bringing it to the table.
Vicky, can I just double check? The glucose was never checked in that admission, or was it just missed by yourself, or was it just not done?
No, never checked at all.
So yeah, so that's a hard one then to come away from. And if it hasn't been checked, it's not like you've missed it. It's just not something that you've done or thought about. And we always know when somebody has a collapse or a blackout or an unresponsive episode, we always run for the BM machine and we always check glucose for that because we always think about hypos. And then when they come in and they're a known diabetic, we always check for the sugars, making sure it's not hypers. But then if it's somebody that's not a diabetic, we don't always routinely check the sugars. And do we need to check sugars in everybody? That's the question. So probably not.
My clinical lead after this case was his previous life before becoming an acute medic was a diabetologist, endocrinologist. And he was quite an advocate of checking sugars because of the number of patients with diabetes out there that aren't diagnosed. And, you know, the type 2 diabetes that have such high risk of complications in later life that it would be well worth picking those up. And for what? Like a simple finger prick test. So he was a real advocate of checking it on everyone.
So can I ask?
I think it's go on, Damien.
So I was going to ask as well, you mentioned about checking serum, urines, osmose, all those things that we always send off for low sodiums. When would you normally send them off? Do you send them off right at the start, right at the front door? Because I always, whenever I was a junior, I always put it in as my plan at the start. And I always felt great about it in the middle of the night. I'm asking for these different investigations. But is that always right that we start them early? Should we wait? What's your thoughts on that?
So certainly if they're on a diuretic, there's no use at all, is there? Because you're just not going to get a meaningful reading. What's really interesting in this case, of course, is that nobody properly looked at that result because it would have given the answer. Because if you look at the equation, it would have shown you that there was something else going on. But nobody really looked at it. I think you need to use your brain a bit more, don't you? And some of these patients, I mean, it's difficult because when I was looking at the pathways as well, how many patients do you see? There's normally a couple that come in who are known to like their beer, and they come in with really low sodiums, and you bring them into hospital for 2 days and you can basically do very little and it'll just self-correct. And you know why they've got a low sodium, or you at least you've got a good idea. And if you just bring them in, it'll rectify itself. And they normally got a sort of a bit of a record of that on their clinical notes as well. So what's the point in doing those tests if you don't need them in those kind of patients? So it is probably worth waiting a little bit, I think. But then in other patients who come in and it's completely unexplained and you really don't know what's going on and they're normal bulimic, I think it can be quite helpful.
I've seen some pathways where it starts off by checking the serum osmolality, because if the serum osmolality is normal, then it's not a true hyponatremia. Yeah. And it's something like a pseudo hyponatremia, for example, due to hyperglycemia. So I think there might be an argument to check a serum osmolality on the bloods when someone has a hyponatremia, because if it's normal, you shouldn't go pursue any further down a hyponatremia route.
Would a high osmo, serum osmo, then make you have thought about HHS and done a glucose? Or did we ever see what a serum osmo was?
If you calculate the osmolarity, it's 2 of the sodiums plus 2 of the potassiums plus the glucose plus the urea. So you need the glucose to do it.
Oh, yeah, good point. What do the labs do?
They don't, obviously, do they? Because if the labs did that, so I don't know how the lab calculator, I'm showing my ignorance, lab calculator. But there was one other point that I wanted to bring up as well. And it's about the other thing that I pondered about was the fact that this man had almost come with a label as a patient who had lots of psychiatric problems, and how quick I was to label him with something related to his psychiatric diagnosis. And you see that quite a lot as well. So in patients with learning difficulties or mental health disease, we're looking for almost other things that go in association with that. And that if you do that, you get a bit blinkered to the other, all the other diagnoses. So if it had been somebody who had no past psychiatric history at all that was sat there drinking water, would I have gone, oh, you're very thirsty. Thirst, are you passing water a lot? Oh, let's check a BM. I don't know. It's impossible to say. But was the fact that I knew he had psychiatric issues sort of playing into my diagnostic sort of field of possible diagnoses there?
Was he on any weird and wonderful meds?
Yes.
Lithium or anything like that?
I really can't remember. I was trying to remember before I did this podcast what he was on. But it was something that really increases your risk of getting type 2 diabetes. And again, if I'm just thinking about that.
Yeah, I don't necessarily think that's a bad thing to have thought about that then, if he's on, patients with mental health issues are on medications that can cause a lot of issues with sodium. Yeah. So there's no, I don't think it's a bad thing that you thought, okay, he's got mental health issues, he's on medications, could it be related to that?
Yeah.
I don't think it's a bad thing.
I think, you know, mental health patients and actually that kind of label kind of conundrum is a fundamental issue that we face in acute medicine, isn't it? And I think that and anchoring are two massive issues for us as acute medicine. And my juniors will smirk if they're listening to this about that kind of label element of thing, because I spend my life tearing up labels that come in with patients. And I get very annoyed that every time a patient with IBD presents with diarrhea, well, it must be their IBD flare, when actually there's lots of other potential causes of diarrhea in a patient. Just because they've got IBD doesn't mean that's definitely it. It probably is. But making an assumption like that is usually when you make an arse out of yourself. And so that kind of labels is one fundamental problem we get into in acute medicine. And I seem to spend my life with people's diagnosis going, well, who gave you that diagnosis? And if it wasn't a credible specialist in that field, I'm very cynical about that label, because for that very reason. And I think that and anchoring are two massive issues for us as a specialty and every clinician working in acute medicine. And I think this case highlights that. You know, and who's to say that the psychiatric diagnosis in this gentleman was in your thinking at all, particularly, but you know, we see that all the time in other patients, and you know, and like you say, the kind of alcohol related person who comes in and out all of the time with their alcohol related issue, but actually one of those times it's an acute problem that actually needs a different management, and it's picking up that time versus their alcohol withdrawal or alcohol related complication, and so kind of trying to keep ourselves aware to all of that is incredibly difficult, I think. And
I also think that's the kind of thing that really changes between 9 o'clock in the morning, hot on first patient, and 9:30 at night when you just can't wait to get home and you're tired. I reckon those, because your knowledge base is the same, isn't it? Your decision making changes slightly, and you're just slightly less sharp around the edges. And I think that's when you're more vulnerable to things like diagnostic drift and anchoring bias and that kind of thing. And I think we just have to be really aware of that. So you almost have to question yourself more. And I certainly, and I don't know about you guys, but I make safer decisions maybe at 9 o'clock at night than I do at 9 o'clock in the morning. Safe is the wrong word, isn't it? But I'm much more likely to discharge a patient at the beginning of my shift than at the end of my shift for that reason. I'd love to study it really, about how many more investigations I do in the patients at the end rather than at the beginning, how much more I use my pragmatism at the beginning of a shift than at the end. It'd be fascinating to see. Maybe we don't, but it just feels like it.
So something that you commented on as well is about checking everything and knowing, not missing out and stuff. And obviously I've recently become a new consultant, and obviously it's my fear that I'm going to miss something. And I come away from a patient and I'm thinking, oh, have I checked the meds? And if I haven't, I go back and I'm like, right, let's check the meds again. Or have I looked at the gas? Have I looked at the radiology? Is there something that I've missed? And if I've missed an ECG, I go back and have a look at it again. Does that feeling ever go away that you're always you're possibly going to miss stuff? I know from some of your great talks before, Vic, that not just going by what somebody tells you, having a look at the whole picture, seeing everything, not just like say the potassium, look at the whole kidney function. And it's does that ever disappear as you go on in your career?
I recalculated how many years I've been a consultant the other day, and it really scared me. So yeah, so I'm now in my, eighth year as being a consultant, and absolutely not. Okay. The worry of missing something. Yeah, I don't know. I can also tell when I'm a bit more stressed or tired because it's how much I think about stuff at home. I think for as long as I'm a doctor, I'm always going to struggle after a long day. So we finish a long shift at, we're supposed to finish at 10, that often runs a bit late, and then you get home and then you go to bed. And it's really common that I'll wake up in the middle of the night thinking, crikey, did I check this, that, or the other, or what if it isn't this, that, and the other? And I kind of come to terms with that because it's one day a week, and I got into the habit of writing it into my notepad at the side of my bed, and half the time the next morning it's nothing really to worry about. But normally after a day shift when I get home, it's not so much of a problem. But I can tell when I'm getting a bit more stressed or tired, because then I'm beginning to think about stuff more when I get home, and that normally is a sign for me that I'm due some annual leave. But in terms of the checking and that sort of thing, I think I'm probably a bit more comfortable now, but yes, I still feel that. What do you two more normal people think, Peter and
Mike? I'm not sure I get called normal that often, but I think it depends. I think there are some cases that feel comfortable and more straightforward, and I'm comfortable, I've checked most stuff, and they're kind of ones that I can park and move on. But I think in most times, particularly in like a 12-hour shift, there's usually a case that sits a bit less comfortably, that you're not completely convinced you've got all the info you want, or even if you've kind of gone back to it. And those are the ones that do take a bit of time, and I need a period of time to unwind after those long shifts. And I think on some levels, if there aren't some cases that make you think about things and want to go back and dig into, you're probably not in the right job. And I think that will remain. And if that goes away from me, that's probably the time I need to think about doing something different.
Yeah, I think I completely agree with you, Mike, because I think it completely depends on the case you're seeing. So some are really straightforward, some cases that you really put a lot of mental energy into and spend a lot of time looking at everything, particularly when you don't know what's going on. And I think they're the cases that I struggle with, because they do stress me out, and I do worry about those patients in particular, which is in some respects, those are the patients that I not breeze over, but spend less time with. I do worry in hindsight whether did I do that a bit too quickly, or did I miss something. But then again, I haven't been a consultant as long as Mike and Vicky here, so I don't know. I've still got a lot to learn, so don't listen to anything I say.
I think what I've learned over the years, one of the things I've started to do, is you will always follow up those interesting cases, won't you? You know, the ones you see where you don't have a clue what's going on, or they're really interesting, and you always follow those up, and you will always learn things from them. But one of the things you learn is that everybody else didn't really know initially either. The other thing I do, and it's much easier now we've got electronic notes, but I randomly used to select stickers from two or three patients a ward round, where it was dead easy, exacerbations of COPD or a paracetamol overdose or whatever, to follow those ones up. And over the years, those have been the ones that I've learned probably the most from. just because you think it's oh so simple, and then they go up to the ward and then something else happens. And it's things like, you know, a small lung cancer on a chest x-ray that you've missed, and you go back and you think, should I have seen that? But I wouldn't know if I, because that was just a barn door, COPD exacerbation, high CRP, green sputum. So you wouldn't, and no one feeds that back to you. No one's going to email you and go, by the way, Vicky, there was this, that, and the other on the chest x-ray you missed. They'll feed the bad, bad stuff back. But we're missing stuff all the time. And over the years, I've definitely learned more from the cases that I thought, you know, I knew what was going on in a different type of way, I think, maybe. But yeah, I think it's worth following up the cases where you think, yeah, this was dead easy.
So you said that, IT and electronic notes and things like that, they are great for following up patients. I've noticed that sometimes whenever you're in a ward round and you've got these multiple different systems that you're having to look up the different results, that can lead sometimes to you missing or forgetting to look at things. Mm. If the IT system for whatever radiology you're looking up, I'll not say any specific names, breaks down while you're trying to look at it, and then you go see the patient and you forget to look at it later on, then you've missed looking at that x-ray because of that system not working. So IT, although I don't particularly want to go back to the days of films, not that I remember that, but still, I don't particularly want to go back to that, but IT doesn't always help. Sometimes IT can hinder as well. I know that's a completely different topic to talk about now, but
you've got to have a system.
See what your thoughts are.
You've got to have a system. So yeah, one of our colleagues developed a mnemonic for the ward round, which has helped me no end, which is just very bored, but it's V bored. And V is have I done the VTE. B is have I looked at the bloods. O is the obs. R is radiology, E is ECG, and D is the drug chart. Because exactly like you've just said, I was just not checking the drug chart. Because before, when you had them in the end of the bed, you had the obs chart, the drugs chart, you pick them up, you look at them, and it was just always done. And now the drugs are on a computer system, which is a different system to everything else, especially on the more straightforward cases, just forget to look at the drug chart. So I like to think that I remember it by using that mnemonic, and that's the only way I get around it.
That's interesting, because that's a challenge I'm going to face soon. We're just about to implement EPM, you know, electronic prescribing in our site, and so going from a paper chart that I can easily access at the moment is going to be something I'm going to have to work through, I think. But like I say, how do you know you've looked at everything? I probably don't in some cases. We're brutally honest, there's probably cases where I've not particularly looked at ECG because I've not thought it's particularly relevant, and then thought about it later and randomly gone back and looked at a set of notes. So we are all human, and it's, like I say, certain things to try and make us more reliable at picking up some of that. But also, I suppose, knowing there's other systems in place and that they're going to pick up aspects of that as well.
Have your medical student trail round with B-board written on a piece of paper after every patient? Have you done this? Have you done this?
Reminding
they,
you.
They feel very powerful with that.
Do you think this is something similar to when we do examinations as well? If you don't, because we don't necessarily have to do a full examination of every patient that we see in post-take. You don't do chest, abdo, resp, neuro. You don't do that in every single patient. Is that something similar or different, or how do you view that? Stunned silence.
No, I was seeing it. I was going to get somebody else to talk. I'm too mouthy.
I think it's a challenge. I think it's a balance, and I think it's the cases that feel very straightforward. I will probably do a very focused examination on something, and I think the ones that feel less comfortable are the ones where I go, something just doesn't feel right. I'm just going to look at a wider aspect of this person, you know, the fever and kind of been delirium, and, you know, A&E have said they're a UTI because of a positive urine dip, and actually there's no meaningful urinary symptoms. The chest sounds pretty clear. Those are the people that I'm probably liable to strip down pretty aggressively and go looking for other things and stuff, because I just don't feel comfortable we've found the source. And I still might not find it, but those are ones where I'll probably go looking when I feel less comfortable.
the amount of times that I've found ulcers, infected ulcers in feet, when you take the socks off and the toe falls off, those type of things.
Precious. I've been known to find the odd pressure sore that's clearly infected that nobody's thought about.
So COVID, I think, had a huge impact there because for a while, nobody was touching patients. Like, people were leaving their stethoscope in the office. And I definitely started examining people a lot less, and I've completely gone back to examining people again. So I think there's two reasons. One is I think we have to value our skills as a physician in examining people because we have got something to offer. And I found quite a lot actually since I've started examining people again. Not, don't get me wrong, exactly like Mike says, focused exam, unless I really, there's a need for me to sort of do a more thorough one. But the other one is for the patient. And I can't bring this to the top of my mind, and I might be imagining it, but I'm sure there's something out there, isn't there, about patient satisfaction scores. And if the doctor listens to their chest with a stethoscope, the satisfaction score of the patient immediately goes up because they feel like they've been seen properly.
That was presented at one of the sound conferences a few years back by, was it Abraham Verghese, the guy from Stanford who does bedside medicine?
I'm not imagining it, which is always good. No. But I think that's true, isn't it? It's kind of like, even if it's a slightly a PR thing, but I do, not doing the actual PR, that's a totally different, that's an unnecessary examination sometimes. But yeah, I think it's important. And I think it's probably, it might be controversial, but I think we don't do it enough, actually. And part of that, I reckon the reason is because we're all too time pressured. We're just trying to get through the number of patients as quickly as we can, and we think, well, we've got a chest x-ray, so what's the point in listening to the chest? And you know, I think we should do it more, but possibly controversial.
Thank you all for listening to another episode of the Society for Acute Medicine podcast. We hope this episode has been interesting and helpful for you all. Please do go to the SAM website at www.acutemedicine.org.uk for all things acute medicine, including show notes from today's episode under the education menu. You will also find more info about acute medicine, the team, and how to contact us individually. Please do get in touch with us via Twitter using @acutemedpod. And let us know what you thought, as well as topics you'd love to see us explore in future episodes, or if you'd like to just get involved. Thanks again for listening, and we hope you join us next time.